Thank you very much for joining us this evening on the Unknown Strength podcast, where we aim to provide high-quality information and insights into the fight game and strength and conditioning training, which translates into optimal performance in the cage, the mat, or the ring. I'm your host, McGregor McNair. With me are my co-hosts, Brenton McKitterick and Steve Phillips. And we have a very special guest with us tonight, the one and only Coach Chris Shen.
Thanks, Mac. I was really excited about this interview. I remember seeing Chris for the first time as a newly minted brown belt competing at one of the very first more grappling tournaments held at Dominance. And as I understand it, Brenton, he was also pretty close by for one of your early competitive experiences.
Yes, thank you, Steve. This is true. Chris did actually officiate one of my first grappling experiences, which was definitely an interesting experience. Now, this podcast, I'm absolutely elated to have Chris on. Considering my own personal fascination with the mental game of peak performance and grappling with the actual challenges of getting your head in the game, pardon the pun, gentlemen, Chris's insight, I think, was I greatly appreciate his insight on this podcast, considering he elaborated on the mental health in society, resilience, strength and conditioning, wrestling, his MMA officiating experiences, as well as his upcoming book, Wrestling with Resilience.
Yeah, Coach Chris, was an absolute pleasure to interview as well. I think everyone in the fight game is going to take a lot out of this interview. The insights that he shared were amazing. And finally, we'd like to thank Fuck the Fitzroy Doom Scene for our theme song called Dream. And without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please enjoy the interview.
Chris, really excited to have you on this podcast. You're quite the omniscient force in the Australian scene. Psychologist at your own private clinic, psychologist to multiple national representative teams, consultant and author, a wrestling coach with Team Takedown, which I understand is a non-profit team that you both created and run. You're an MMA official, featured in both UFC and other several other major MMA organizations, as well as an accomplished martial artist yourself with over 40 years of experience that predominantly spans wrestling, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, MMA, as well as Taekwondo, Karate, and Judo. And last but not least, you're a very distinguished gentleman with quite an eloquent vocabulary.
Thank you, Brenton. Thank you, sir. That's very kind. I think my job's done. I'll just leave now.
Roll the credits.
Brenton, Steve and Mac, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Excellent, excellent. So 40 years of martial arts, what was it that got you started?
Two things. The first is my parents. I was born and raised in country Victoria in Traralgon in the 1970s. And we, at one point, we were the only Asian family in all of the La Trobe Valley, and my dad, who was the pharmacist at the local hospital, thought it was prudent for myself and my older brother Albert to learn martial arts firstly. So that's the first influence, which happened without my awareness. And the second was Bruce Lee. So in the 70s, Bruce Lee was huge. In fact, my mum has a photo of me probably at about two or three with a Bruce Lee t-shirt on. So I think it was Bruce Lee as well.
Excellent. Okay, so you're also a psychologist. Mm-hmm. Was it a defining moment or something that inspired you to pursue a career in this field?
Indeed. There were two things. So the first, in reference to your very good question, when the Australian tennis player Pat Cash won Wimbledon in 1987, I was watching it. I love all sport, and I was watching him late night on television win the Wimbledon trophy over Ivan Lendl, and then he went up into the stands in a Crocodile Dundee kind of way and stepped over people and hugged his entourage, and one of whom was his sports psychologist.
Right.
And I, as a young Year 11 student, I actually thought, that's really interesting. That athletes can actually have members of their support team who help them with the mental side. So that was the specific moment. An overall or an overarching moment or influence is I've always been interested in human behaviour. When I was in school, I always found myself analysing and interpreting the behaviour of my friends, peers and other school teachers. And I've always been particularly interested in anthropology, in detective work, in archaeology, and of course, I came to realise human behaviour and psychology.
Yeah, so like the why and the motivators behind humanity, really.
Indeed. Hear, hear.
Excellent. So what do you find satisfying about being a psychologist, or, and specifically, you're a sports psychologist? What are the major differences there?
Thank you. With regards to your first question, I find it an enormous privilege to be able to help individuals and organisations with their mental health to diminish barriers and restrictions and to be able to give them tools that they can use to flourish and perform to their best. With regards to sport and exercise psychology, because I recognise that the purpose of this delightful podcast is also about strength, conditioning, physical performance. With regards to sport and exercise psychology, it is the one area of psychology, which seeks to enhance high performers and to take them to their full potential, whereas so many other parts or specialities of psychology, such as clinical psychology, such as counselling psychology, we see our patients, we see individuals when they are distressed, when they're experiencing poor functioning, and we're trying to bring them back up to some normality.
Oh, excellent. So indubitably, there has to be a lot of crossovers or at least consistencies that you identify as both. I mean, you're a coach to several teams and you consult to teams. Mm-hmm. There has to be a lot of consistencies there, you know, as your role as a coach and psychologist.
Oh, indeed. In fact, often when I work with sporting teams and athletes and coaches, I actually explicitly tell the coach that he or she is working as a psychologist. You know, you're actually, one of your roles is also the motivator, is also to pick up your players and your fellow coaches when they're down after a loss or they're frustrated or they lose composure in a bout or a match. Absolutely, there's huge overlaps between coaching and psychology. Where the limitations are from a psychologist are the psychologist focuses on the morale, the mental health, the emotional health, the psychological skills of the individual or the athlete. He or she is not to stray into technical coaching, game coaching, that area.
Yep. Excellent, thanks.
So, Chris, for a fight athlete, or for somebody that's training in the martial arts or training in the gym, mm-hmm. The idea of visiting perhaps a sports psychologist might be a new idea to a number of our listeners. Mm-hmm. We're good at preparing on the physical side for, mm-hmm. for competition or for practice. Mm-hmm. Why should someone come and see a sports psychologist?
Thank you, Steve. Great questions. Firstly, no one needs to see a psychologist or see anybody for that matter. And the reason I immediately reframe that very good question is we don't want individuals to feel a sense of burden that they must see a psychologist or they must see a particular person. Rather, a counter question I pose to us all here today is, why might it be helpful to see a psychologist, to see a sport and exercise psychologist? And my response to that question, I just asked him, answering my own question here, is that much like we develop our technical skills as an athlete, much like we develop our physical performance and conditioning, much like we address our diet and nutrition, it's equally as important that we focus on a mindful understanding of the mental side of our game. And sometimes the very fact that we've just been quite successful as an athlete or a coach without any dedicated focus on the mental side is serendipitous rather than you developing and being equipped with a good range of psychological skills. So one of the things that a psychologist in sport and exercise can do is to provide protocols, paradigms, techniques and resources that the athlete or coach can draw upon when the situation is evokes, and so he or she then is well resourced and well armed. Steve,
great, thanks. Your question was better than mine too.
something I particularly noticed, you know, in recent years, or even probably more towards a decade, there's been quite a stigma surrounding mental health, yeah. and even being able to identify with depression. I mean, you're seeing trends recently, like the Are You Okay Day, mm-hmm. even fighters coming forward, and fight athletes, and athletes across many disciplines coming forward, and you know, admitting and coming forth with the fact that they're struggling with mental health issues. Mm-hmm. Now, is that something I guess you've seen a trend yourself, or mm-hmm. you know, being reflected in perhaps your work without giving specific examples, but is that something that's starting to be a bit more of a common theme?
Great questions. Absolutely. As a psychologist, I am thrilled with the greater recognition of the importance of mental health, especially for men in our society, in our Australian society.
Absolutely.
Where men typically have been stoic. We haven't admitted that we may have any despairing thoughts or even not be confident, and we've not sought help. I've been really fortunate and blessed to collaborate with some mental health organisations to implement some mental health initiatives in some of my client organisations. And I've been really, really thrilled with initiatives such as Are You OK Day and the great work of organisations such as Beyond Blue and others.
Excellent, excellent. So, I mean, regarding your own competition experience, you know, a bit of a, you know, bringing it back to the past, did you get nervous
at
the time?
Not that long ago.
Not that long ago? did you get nervous at the time, and were you a psychologist at that point of time?
Great questions. The first question, did I get nervous? Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I faced a conundrum, and that conundrum that's faced by many a professional or an expert in what we do is physician heal thyself. And I knew that I was faced that conundrum. What I mean by that is often a plumber will have leaking pipes at home because he or she may, one, just not...
bring your work home.
Correct. Or secondly, may be a really bad client of himself as well.
Yeah.
So as a... I was doing my master's in sports psychology when I was competing. I became registered as a psychologist and I was still competing. And I recognised that there were areas of my mental side that I wanted to improve. And I recognised even though I had great theoretical and even applied knowledge, I was working with athletes and clients, that I can't treat myself. I can't be fully objective. So I engaged as a sports psychologist.
Oh, excellent. So yeah. It's obviously, you know, self-awareness is paramount there.
Indeed. Here. And I put it to all of us here that in order to initiate development or change or continue to improve an understanding of yourself, self-awareness, you very nicely described it, Brenton, is critical, is absolutely important. Here.
Excellent. So in regards to your own... experience in this profession, are there certain consistencies that you identify that really inhibit athletes from achieving their peak performance? Or are there some more general trends or themes that you find?
Thank you, Brenton. And I'd like to answer this in the context of strength and conditioning and physical performance, which is the remit of your delightful podcast. Broadly speaking, I'm not calling on any research as I'm sitting here. Broadly speaking, my anecdotal observations are that an athlete will derail him or herself by pushing through pain, so not recognising the difference between muscular discomfort or muscular soreness.
A proper injury.
Correct. And they'll get what is sometimes called hot spots, and they'll push through it. Then they will dispel the advice to undertake proper assessment and rehabilitation by just pushing through it. And so they will often create a long-lasting injury that is both physically and psychologically derailing where they needn't have done that. So that's one of the more common derailers I see mentally in strength conditioning and physical performance. Another is a tendency to jump on trends. And let me contrast a trend with an innovative, creative practice or protocol that is based on empirical research.
Yeah.
Knowing, of course, that empirical research has to be longitudinal.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes it can't be creative in both. I've seen a lot of trends in physical performance, strength and conditioning that have been dangerous to the athlete sometimes seem to be more a commercial consideration of whoever's promoting it rather than a good practice as well.
Excellent. So from a psychologist's point of view, what can you actually convey on the topic of downtime? So we understand that rest is vital to recovery. So how do you factor in downtime and why is it important if so?
I'll answer that in two ways if I may, please.
Yeah, please.
Brenton, Stephen and Mac. Firstly, downtime is absolutely critical for us to restore ourselves physically and psychologically. As many of your listeners who are coaches and trainers would know, when we're stressed, or more precisely, when we are distressed, we release blood, serum, cortisol. What that does is that diminishes our ability to restore ourselves and to recover, and it impairs healing and the development of musculature and so forth. Furthermore, blood, serum, cortisol is also associated with fatigue, with tiredness, with a diminishment of creativity and innovation. And so it is absolutely critical that we schedule purposefully in rest, which includes sleep. How much sleep? Enough sleep for the person to have enough rapid eye movement sleep where we restore ourselves. And also that they schedule in hobbies, activities, social interactions that they find to be pleasurable, that they find to be restorative and enhances them as well. Now, the second question I'd like to answer, or the second way of answering, is with regards to myself. What I deliberately do is I schedule in flourishing time. That's time with my partner. That's also, and time with your partner is not the same as incidental time of living together, you know, and doing things together. It's purposeful activities together. And also I make sure that I exercise quite rigorously above and beyond my coaching activities.
Excellent.
Great. Thanks, Chris. So you've done a lot of work with the National Lawn Bowls team.
I have. That's on public record. Absolutely.
It is. Now, what these guys don't know is that I actually come from a long line of bowls talent.
Ah!
So my grandmother as well as my stepdad. So,
really?
So, yeah.
Okay.
There you go. So is there a piece of advice that you can give me about the mental game that you've seen in working with your athletes generally that you've seen almost like a trigger or a switch, like that aha type experience where you've been able to provide some advice to somebody and really break them out of or perhaps a rut?
Mm-hmm. Firstly, I commend you and your family for your involvement with bowls. It's a magnificent sport, and I was privileged to work with the bowls team. Stephen, yes. Not only did I see this, and I speak broadly, not only did I see this from bowlers with whom I gleefully worked, I also see this with all athletes. A common derailer is one's inability to put out of one's mind disappointment, particularly in a sport like bowls where you continue playing after you've bowled a particular shot. And where a bowler or an athlete is disappointed with how he or she's gone in the set, and if they allow that disappointment to disrupt their game plan, their morale, their thinking, then that starts affecting their micro skills of performing the task in ways that is almost imperceptible to them, yet their coach will recognise that. In representative bowls where you're playing with other team members in teams, it may affect your communication with your fellow team members. So one of the things we endeavour to do is to give people skills in recognising when they've been derailed and then being able to implement tools to recover their composure.
Great. So quite similar to golf in that you're only one shot away from disaster or success, depending on how you respond.
Here, there's that, there's that Rudyard Kipling quote, which I'll massacre here, that to treat success and failure as imposters, you know, and the same thing happens in so many sports. MMA, where I am blessed to officiate, particularly when I'm working as a referee, a competitor could be dominating and then suddenly submitted or concussed. Brenton and Steve, you're both coaches, you're both accomplished black belts in jiu-jitsu. You both know that you can win or lose instantaneously with a submission. You know yourself, Coach Mack, as a strength and conditioning coach of various combat athletes, how success or failure can turn almost on a dime. So one's ability to be able to recognise that can happen, accept it, both success and failure, and to be able to recover from disappointments is critical.
Great, thank you. So just in terms of my own training, so it during competitive phases of my training, a big part of my mental preparation has actually been around putting the effort into the physical preparation, mm-hmm. and thinking that if I feel like physically and technically I'm ready to go, then the mental side of that preparation by default has taken care of itself. Mm-hmm. Is that a mistake? And if so, is that a common error?
Thank you, Steve. My question to you is, how are you going in competition?
That's why I should have mentioned that. My cupboard's full of silver medals.
Firstly, congratulations on the silvers. Broadly speaking, it is a sound, intuitive strategy to draw confidence from your physical conditioning and fitness and then your technical side. Unfortunately, what can happen, and I'll extrapolate away from you now, Steve, what can happen to athletes is they may have fragile composure and mental skills that is then absolutely contingent upon their physical state and or their technical state. Whereas if you are able to focus dedicatedly, sorry, I think I made a word up there, James, in a dedicated manner on your mental game at the same time, concurrently with your physical conditioning and your technical side, then if you get injured, if somebody is beating you technically, you can still deploy your mental game and not only tolerate or endure, so you can still master. How many times, chaps, have we pulled a Hail Mary submission out? You know, when somebody's fitter, stronger, younger, which is often happening to me these days, based on the fact that you are resilient, you know, that you've got good psychological skills. Yep.
I think for me, you just described about 90% of the population, fitter, younger, faster, but never mind.
Well, apart from Breton here, we could possibly call this show Grumpy Old Men at this point in time.
Thank you.
Great. So look, you've been a jiu-jitsu brown belt since 2006.
I have, that's true.
And I remember seeing you fight in jiu-jitsu at the first time at an old dominance competition.
Oh my God!
One of the very early more grappling competitions. Oh, wow. I think it was the first time that I ever saw a brown belt compete. So thank you for that experience.
A unicorn back in the day.
Well, yeah. In fact, you would have just seen me wrestle essentially
with
guard pass.
Yeah, absolutely. So 10 years later, you're still a brown belt.
Oh, yeah.
Are you sandbagging?
that's fighting words, Steve. My reason and rationale for that is that I regrettably stopped my dedicated jiu-jitsu training in 2011, where I sustained a serious knee injury. Since then, I've primarily been... I'm delighted to attest that I had a second knee op in March last year and have had a great success rate, so thank you to my
Fantastic.
Surgeon. Oh, thank you. And during that period of time, I've been focused on coaching wrestling, submission wrestling or catch wrestling, and all of my athletes, which I'm sure we'll speak to perhaps, at Team Takedown, are jiu-jitsu players or mixed martial art competitors or both. And I delightfully defer to their own coaches in those disciplines, and I coach them wrestling and the transition from whatever their sports are, whether it be striking or groundwork, from wrestling to those sports.
Great.
Now, having said that, my knee op was so successful, and I'm surrounded by jiu-jitsu players, and my, in fact, three of my Team Takedown members are BJJ black belts, several of them are brown belts, and several black belts in the wider community of jiu-jitsu. I coached them in their very first class as a white belt. So with my knee at about 85% capacity, I am quite keen to rail at that windmill and try to earn that black belt down the track.
Yep, absolutely.
Excellent.
Great.
Thank you.
Fantastic. And of all the grappling sports that are on your resume, I think one of the most impressive achievements that's on there is you're representing Australia on the wrestling team.
Thank you.
Can you tell us some more about your experience doing that, please?
Thank you, Mac. That was a privilege, and I have extremely fond memories. I've also been able to draw enormous performance accomplishments from that period of time and apply that to not only other areas of my life, including my professional work, also use that as helpful self-disclosure to some of my own athletes, especially when they aspire to greater honours in wrestling or in their other combat sports. I came to wrestling very late. Partly that represents the state of wrestling in Australia. I started judo at 4 and then karate shortly thereafter, and much throughout the 1970s and 1980s it was almost impossible to find a wrestling school. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu didn't exist in its current form, at least up until perhaps 1993 in Australia, and so I trained in. I realised I liked grappling. I really liked grappling. I liked, and it's since been pointed out to me by several wrestling coaches, including, and I'll name drop here because he's no longer associated with the organisation, and I wasn't officiating at the time, Randy Couture, who looked at me at the time I was travelling with him, helping him run seminars in Australia with underneath the coaches, and he actually said I had the perfect wrestling physique. So for your listeners who can't see me, I'm about 5'7 and a half, 5'8. I'm reasonably stocky. I'm about 95, 96 kilos. I've got a low centre of gravity. I've got flat feet. Now, Randy said that's super important because he has flat feet, and we're both about size 11.
So you're basically saying you're the quintessential beast.
Well, what I'm saying is I've got a very good grappling background, and psychologically, whilst I competed in karate, I had 4 mixed martial art fights. I like wrapping myself around someone. I love throwing them, and I love, which is why I've really taken to Eric Pawson's catch wrestling. I love cranking and tearing.
Okay, just keep yourself at arm's distance from me then.
That must have lit you up when you know, UFC Hall of Famer and former champion compliments you and says you're the perfect build.
I didn't know he had a wry smile at the time, yet I was absolutely...
Take it.
I was absolutely thrilled.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Coach Chris, tell me, what was one of the most difficult things about your transition from your previous martial arts into wrestling?
Thank you. Can I expand that question, please, Mac?
Please do.
From my previous martial arts to wrestling to striking martial arts to grappling. Throughout most of the 70s, apart from a short period of time when I was 4 and 5 in judo, which was great because it gave me a love of grappling, and it saved me because it taught me how to break fall, and gave me a sense of kinesthesia that served me well in my whole athletic life. I primarily did striking martial arts right throughout my adolescence and early teens. Karate, predominantly Goju karate, Taekwondo, Shunji Kenpo, a whole heap of other striking martial arts, some kickboxing in those weird PKA days. Yeah. Those, you know, where they wore gi pants, and you know, it was very strange.
Yeah.
Then, even though I had been exposed to grappling in martial arts such as Taijutsu by, can I name a few coaches?
Absolutely,
I'd like to attribute,
please do.
Coach Kevin McMenamin, who was a brilliant overall martial artist. Soke Tony Ball in Fudoshin had also taught me some outstanding grappling. And we had some in the Bunkai in the Kata in Goju under my sensei, Gary Williams, and Kancho Tino Sobrano. I really only experienced true grappling when I started training with my brother Albert, with John Will, in what he was then calling shoot fighting in Melbourne in about 1992, 1993. So Albert and I attended John's very first class in Melbourne. John, at that stage, was the editor of Blitz Martial Art magazine, and he was travelling all around interviewing people. He came into our karate headquarters, our Hombu Dojo, to interview karate masters that Tino Sobrano, Kancho would bring. He dropped off some pamphlets saying that he was about to start teaching this Brazilian system of jiu-jitsu. And this is before Gracie in Action. This is before UFC. And so Albert and I, as avid martial artists, decided to wander down. And at that stage, I'd done a stack of martial arts. I had represented and medalled in intervarsity judo. And I thought, well, what's this little guy? Now, I gave respect to him, of course. This little John was a little guy. What might he be able to show us with this new system? So I was quite open to that. And it blew my mind away that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu had a system of controls where, and John beautifully demonstrated this with his lovely wife, where she must have been, in fact, I'm not even going to endeavour to offend anybody, she was quite a slight athletic lass, and we had, in that first class, law enforcement and military operatives who were big guys, much like me, about 100 kilos, and she swept them from guard, choked them, knee rode them, and it spun us out. Now, of course, you know, the two of you here at BJJ Black Belts, Mac, you're an experienced trainer, two Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu athletes. Of course, we know that's the case. Back in 1992, it was mind-blowing.
It was unprecedented.
Mind-blowing.
Well, people still didn't even recognise that until UFC 1 years later.
It was astounding, and it changed the martial arts journey for so many of us. So there's photos around of that very first cohort, which concurrently was happening in other states as well, of Australia, where many of us left our striking martial arts and focused on BJJ. Now, that's an extreme. Perhaps what we should have done is integrate it more.
Yeah. You
know? Yet we were just like so...
All-consuming.
We were gleeful, absolutely gleeful with that. Now, in hindsight, I'd actually met Horian Gracie. He was actually brought out on a tour in about 1991 by Sheehan Barry Bradshaw from the Australian Society of Jiu-Jitsu Practitioners, I think it's called, to run a seminar. And at that stage, they weren't calling it Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. He brought out a very, very famous black belt now, who's a brown belt, whose name is escapes me, and ran some public seminars. So I found this photo years later when I was training with John with it. Hey, hang on, I've trained with this bloke before, and so forth. Yeah.
Excellent.
So that's your journey from striking to grappling.
Correct.
What about from jiu-jitsu to wrestling? This is what I really want to know.
Thank you, Coach Mac. This happened because Albert and I, my lifelong training brother, my brother Albert Shen, Dr. Albert Shen, what we did is we befriended Eric Pawson.
Friend to have.
Yeah. over the internet, in the early days of the internet, before there was like graphic user interfaces and so forth. So we were like typing, you know. And he had just won the World Light Heavyweight Shooto Championship of the World. Shooto, yep. Was one, and still, it was one of the prominent, then they called it Vale Tudo, now we call it mixed martial arts organizations. And he was a Caucasian. Who had won this title. And Albert approached him, and we were invited by Coach Eric to go over and undertake his intensive combat submission wrestling instructor's course in 1997 at the Inosanto Academy in Marina del Rey in California. And anyway, whilst we were there training all week, there was a wrestling group training, because it was a multidisciplinary setting at the same time. I was really interested. I was watching, so I knew, of course, about wrestling. And the coach saw me interested and invited me to come and have a grapple with one or two of the lads. And I actually remember thinking, well, I've done judo for a long time. I'm now doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. You know, I'm training with Coach Eric.
So how long have you been training Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu at this point?
I was still a white belt. So probably about 3 years,
right.
I think.
And yep.
These guys torched me. They absolutely torched me. And my mind was once again blown. I had an epiphany, an absolute epiphany. And then asked the coach, well, what's all this? And he said, well, it's wrestling, son. When you get back to where you're from, when you get back to Melbourne, you should look up, you know, the coaches there. And came back to Australia, hunted around, and started training wrestling with Coach Tony Russo, who was training with a coach, sorry, I don't know his surname, Ziggy, and then eventually started training under Coach John Donoghue, who was a black belt, who is a black belt under Gene LaBelle, and also one of Australia's most decorated wrestlers, Coach Chris Brown.
Fantastic.
Who finished third in Abu Dhabi back in 1999, I believe?
A little bit earlier than that, Coach Chris actually was the first person to beat Henzo Gracie.
Yeah, Henzo Gracie was a massive ordeal.
Beautiful throw. Which has been immortalised. Coach Chris competed twice. I believe he came fourth. I could be doing Coach Chris a disservice there.
Right.
Yet he competed magnificently in the early days of ADCC.
And that might be the further any of an Australian athlete has gone as far as Abu Dhabi.
Actually, I believe Stacey Cartwright. She won a gold medal, I believe, in ADCC. I believe that might be the case.
Okay, fantastic.
That's International amazing. Women's Day earlier this week.
It was.
So props to Stacey.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, it's great. And so what can you tell us about Team Takedown? This is the million-dollar question as far as I'm concerned, because as you guys know, I've had a bit of exposure to Team Takedown and I've been absolutely blown away by what you guys do on the mat. So please just share with us what Team Takedown's all about, how you got started.
Thank you. Thank you for your compliments. Team Takedown is a not-for-profit wrestling club that I am blessed to coach. It's invitation only. At this present moment, we have 13 active wrestlers, plus one valued member in Townsville, Fiona Muxlow, who fought Chris Justino.
Cyborg.
And is one of Australia's pioneers of grappling. And I'm very honoured for Fee to be a member of Team Takedown. We started in 2006, where I left the jiu-jitsu club where I had been training and doing some coaching to endeavour to reach the Australian Olympic team for the Beijing Olympics. Myself and my brother, my long-standing assistant coach Trent Thiessens, and a long-standing student Mark Mandel got together and started training once a week in Richmond at the Muscle and Body Shape Gym, where there's an open area. We started just drilling, wrestling, essentially to try to get me as prepared as possible. Then something interesting happened where I started receiving approaches from different jiu-jitsu players, particularly the more senior lads and lasses, who heard that we were doing this and asked if they could come along. And initially I opened it up and said, absolutely. Then I actually realised if I wanted to create a safe environment, I felt responsible, I needed to do this properly. I needed to create an environment where I wasn't merely doing my own training, that if other people were coming and wanting to learn wrestling, I had to be ethical, I had to be professional, I had to be responsible. And thus Team Takedown started. Now, the ethos of Team Takedown, of course, is we're invitation only because I coach for a passion. I don't charge financially my athletes. Expect and demand that they're committed as athletes, that they have a high degree of safety for each other, that they train to the best of their abilities, that they're respectful. So that's one constellation of attributes. And the second is around their qualities as a person, that they have good moral and ethical character, that they don't engage in activities that would bring them or Team Takedown into disrepute. To that end, I've expelled several people over the years as well.
Fantastic. And tell us a bit about what you guys are trying to accomplish with Team Takedown. What's in the future?
Great question. Currently, into the future and in the past, my aspiration is to develop better human beings through the diligent practice of wrestling.
Fantastic.
So my approach as a martial artist, I'm glad you asked that, but my approach as a martial artist is that we can become better people through diligent practice of the martial arts. Now, we go through periods of time where we compete, particularly when we're quite young, yet if all we are combat athletes, then when our athletic career inevitably comes to an end, then we might not find it meaningful. Whereas if we're martial artists, then we can keep training, we can keep coaching, we can keep being involved for our entire lives. And the samurai, Chinese kung fu masters, martial artists in every culture around the world see themselves as ethical teachers and practitioners, not merely athletes.
So it's really like a spirit or philosophy that you embed into all of your students and help them grow as people. It's fantastic.
Thank you. And thank you. And the fact that I'm a psychologist helps. Yep.
Yeah.
So one of my observations from having trained with a few wrestlers over the years has been their determination. They've been nothing if not dogged about maintaining a good position. They're incredibly hard to sweep, to turn over, to push around. Mm-hmm. Is there something that you do with your wrestlers to help instill that sense of mental toughness?
Yes. In fact, we pride ourselves on our mental toughness and resilience. Mental toughness and resilience can be developed. It can be innate to some people, yet it can absolutely be developed through rigorous practice of a particular endeavour, whether it be sport, it might be some other craft or profession. We develop mental toughness through facing and persisting through adversity. Now, that doesn't mean winning. That doesn't mean achieving your goals. It means picking yourself up in the face of adversity and continuing to persist. So what do you do at Team Takedown? Through rigorous drilling, through grueling cardio.
Which I've witnessed personally. Yeah,
thank you. And through, in a safe environment, we endeavour to push people past what their mind believes they can endure, because the mind breaks before the body does. And then with each instance of somebody pushing to failure, they feel better, they feel a greater sense of resilience, accomplishment, and they can draw upon that the next time.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I've got a question for you about, please. I suppose, people that have felt the downs of life, those who have undergone depression and really had some difficult and trying circumstances. Do you feel that perhaps one way of looking at it is, on the flip side, by understanding and feeling those kinds of experiences, it can allow them to rise even greater because, you know,
absolutely,
they can reflect on what it's like to be low?
Hear, hear. That's a very wise question, Brenton. I put it to you that if we don't experience disappointment, or if an environment is managed that prevents us from experiencing disappointment, then we can never truly develop resilience. Now, I am aware that there are some environments which focus on development, and so then they won't keep track, for example, in game drills, of scores or submissions or whatever it may be. I actually understand that. Having said that, if that is the only environment in which people train and perform, they never truly experience the sharp loss of disappointment, the glaring failure that is so important for us to countenance, to face, and to recover from.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you learn a lot through failure, and that is absolutely tantamount to success.
I hear, hear. Now, of course, we can't just learn, Brenton, Mac and Steve, from failure unless we actually have paradigms and ways to learn and
like
so
scaffolding.
Here, absolutely.
You know what I love about what you've just said is the mind breaks before the body, and the way you try and instill all of that which you've just said into your athletes, I think there's so many parallels with what I'm trying to do with the unknown. Mm-hmm. You know, that fear of the unknown, pushing yourself beyond your comfort zone, like all these kinds of concepts, I think are so well aligned between what you're doing with the Team Takedown and what we do at The Unknown. It's fantastic.
I'm thrilled that you can see those parallels so readily, Coach Mac. That's fantastic. That's fantastic.
Indeed.
I think that also reconciles really clearly with the benefit of engaging in others to assist you in your journey. So we talked at the start of this conversation around self-regulation and how you had to seek some support elsewhere around your own psychological preparation for competition. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the top speed that I think I can go is, of course, my top speed, because I don't know otherwise. It's having other people to push you, to put you into difficult situations. And you know, I think to come back to Brenton's point, it's not failure for failure's sake. It's around the focus and the dedication and the re-energising that happens after that event to prevent it from happening, in an attempt to prevent it from reoccurring.
Indeed.
You come back with a very focused view on where you need to improve because you've had it unceremoniously sometimes pointed out for you.
Yeah.
So it's not fear, it's not the failure component that's important, it's that response.
Hear, hear. And Steve, that resonates with me, that so many team building activities and initiatives involve some physical challenge. Particularly with, say, your work colleagues or a particular cohort or group. And what the theory that underlies a lot of those team-building activities is to break people down, to cause discomfort, to cause inconvenience, and then for people to face that together, then try to come back from that. In of itself, that's a very, very compelling premise, yet only helpful if you actually have that scaffolding that you referred to, Brenton.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because otherwise, if you break people down, and then leave them to their own devices, they're broken people.
Mm.
So you create a safe environment. So my Team Takedown students come to trust me, so I can break them down, absolutely, yet it's in a safe environment.
Absolutely. That's really interesting you point that out. I mean, full disclosure, one of the major motivators for me becoming extremely, seeking to become extremely competitive in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu was obviously A, because I loved it and I want to see how far I could take it, but was B, I mean, I've experienced several periods of my life of crippling anxiety, and I found that jiu-jitsu was one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. About a week out from a competition, I'd start with the sweaty palms, my heart, I'd be waking up with a racing heart, and just be the most terrifying example of being out on the mat and that idea in my mind of being crippled and lost and having everyone disappointed in me. And so I think it's a very crucial platform, I think, to explore yourself and explore success and failure and be able to reconcile with it, as Steve pointed out, and be able to really learn through those challenges. And it's one of the most mentally challenging experiences you can go through, particularly when it's incredibly valuable to you.
Indeed. Firstly, Brett, I commend you and acknowledge your candor there about your own experience. Well done. Which then beautifully dovetails to our earlier discussion about the importance of mental health, especially for men. So well done. You're a role model there, Brenton.
Thank you.
And moreover, with regards to your... nice fist bump there. It's kaboom. Furthermore, with regards to all of the symptoms you describe, well, people face those readily, not only for competition, sometimes turning up to face a difficult co-worker, sometimes facing burgeoning family demands at home, with the birth of a new child, all these sorts of challenges.
A challenge takes many guises.
Now, Coach Chris, to change directions, since this podcast is really a platform to share ideas about strength and conditioning ideas and along with other facets of the fight game. Uh-huh. I'm really interested to know about your background as a strength coach yourself, as a strength athlete yourself, mm-hmm. and just, a bit about your philosophies and methodologies when it comes to strength and conditioning.
Thank you. I'd be delighted to regale you and your listeners. Personally, I started strength training when I was probably about 5 or 6 at home with just some dumbbells. Now,
5 or 6 years old, right?
Yeah. Now, if anybody looks at me now, I'm reasonably imposing because that's many, many years of martial arts. If you look at my older brother, my beloved older brother Albert, he'd be, 70 kilos and quite thin. One of Australia's top submission grapplers who never competed. Now, we had the same physique, and I built myself into who I am. I used to buy, this is slightly embarrassing, muscle...
Was that Max's muscle?
No, it was years before that.
Not Rocco Oppetisano, Australian Muscle Magazine.
Joe Wider used to have a magazine.
Yeah, Muscle Media.
Before that. This is back in the 70s. I used to buy bodybuilding magazines and read them. And this is that classic tail chaps. We grew up in Terrell, we're the only Asian family. We encountered wonderfully welcoming people, also encountered quite a lot of racism.
Yep.
So my dad enrolled us in martial arts. I was punching on with kids in years much older than me for a long time. And my dad would get telephone calls. My dad was the respectable pharmacist of the local hospital. And, oh, Mr. Shen, now your son Chris has been in another fight. And my dad's first question was, well, how much older was the other lad? And it turns out they were years older, because they'd call me a name. And I'd watched too many Bruce Lee films. And it just jumped on them, and started pounding their head into the pavement or something. Anyway, moving beyond that, with regards to... I would use the Arnold Schwarzenegger programs in my local gym.
Of course.
Now, of course, we now know that they were ghostwritten. He actually never did those programs, and it almost killed me. Yet, it gave me confidence, because, of course, when a young guy's growing and there's heaps of testosterone...
I just learned that then as well.
What happens, you throw a barbell at a young lad or lass and give them the worst exercises of the world, which I don't endorse, and they will still develop musculature.
That's
because
right.
of the...
Yes, stimulation. You know,
because it all works.
And so I started getting super muscular. And of course, I was doing karate at that time. The kids stopped bullying me. In fact, in that real, childlike Lord of the Flies way, if you can beat them up, they're suddenly your friends, that sort of thing. So people started befriending me and so forth. And I started developing a self-image as a martial artist, as a capable person and so forth. And of course, without wanting to channel Mr. Miyagi, once you can fight, you don't have to fight. you know.
And it's the art of fighting without fighting. As Bruce Lee coined it.
Hey, fist bump. Kaboom! Good. Now, my formal... Max, waiting for my answer to the formal training.
Let's move this along, gentlemen.
From a strength and coaching perspective, when I got to uni, I was studying psychology, I was doing a Bachelor of Science at Monash University. Not only did I train in every single martial art that was available, I also joined the weightlifting club. A powerlifting coach... by the name of Michael, I'm terribly sorry to Michael, I can't remember his name, from Waverley Weightlifting Club, taught me three moves that have served me my entire life: bench press, deadlift, and squat.
The
foundation of powerlifters. And then my musculature went through the roof.
Yep.
And I loved it, absolutely loved it. It built my core, it built me physically into who I am. Now, from then, I loved it so much, I did a level one, level two strength and conditioning. It was a powerlifting coaching's course. I was delightfully appointed as a strength and conditioning coach with St. Catharines rowing crew, which is on the public record. I also was a high performance coach at Melbourne Park with their official filler tennis squads. And then I bundled strength and conditioning and martial art training into a lot of the sports psychology gigs I had right throughout the 1990s as well. Because, of course, when you're going to a football club and you're the team psychologist, what the players often do is, particularly back in the 1990s, there was a stigma about seeing the psychologist. So what I would do is I'd feed pads to the lads, or I would... which I did at the Western Bulldogs, which is on the public record, that I was down there as their wrestling coach. I challenged the players to a bench press competition, you know, knowing full well that I could beat them, to get credibility, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you get a lot of respect when you can outlift the guys, right?
And then that gave face validity to then the players to want to approach me about personal matters and so forth.
Just looking for that opportunity to strike up a genuine conversation.
Yeah, of course. And I'm lucky enough that I've got a range of attributes that I can do that. I don't necessarily recommend that for any aspiring psychologist.
Of course not. And what about for your fighters and athletes? Is there any kind of philosophies or any particular... methodologies that you guys stick to over at Team Takedown for your wrestling specifically?
May I ask you please to clarify that question a little bit more,
Strength
coach?
And conditioning.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Yes, and yes. Firstly, I defer to their strength and conditioning coach. If I may disclose, you and I, Coach Mac, collaborate with current athletes that are members of Team Takedown.
Correct.
And have in the past as well. So the first thing I do is when I interview someone for Team Takedown, one of the many questions I ask are, what are their competition aspirations? Are you currently competing? If you don't wish to compete, that's okay. What are your aspirations to develop yourself physically? And then I ask, do you have a strength and conditioning coach? And if they don't, then I recommend several people. You're one whom I now recommend, Coach
Mac.
Thank you. If they do, then I invite their coach to come to training, which is what happened with us, so we can build a collaboration and so forth. So I don't direct people down a certain path. Rather, I encourage them to have a specialist because I recognise the limitations of the boundaries of my expertise. I'm there as their wrestling coach. And then I also tell them I'm also a psychologist, so I'll be incorporating some mental skills stuff as well.
Right, so rather than wearing too many hats in the coaching role as head of Team Takedown, you'd defer them to other people for strength and conditioning.
Absolutely, for that specialist knowledge, and because the trouble with being a jack of all trades is you become a master of none.
Indeed.
Excellent. I really like Mac's question. Obviously, personally, because I know the experience having my energy and focus completely sapped by anxiety and that dreaded adrenaline dump, and I touched on that and elaborated a little bit before. Uh-huh. So are there any things or philosophies or techniques that a competitor can do to mitigate or, perhaps mitigate being overwhelmed by anxiety and competition jitters and take control of the situation?
Yes. A tip that can be readily applied by your listeners is to draw upon previous performance accomplishments or to create a psychological state of calmness, of resourcefulness, of stillness that they can draw upon when they find themselves anxious or derailed and so forth. And how your listeners could do that is either recall a time where they were very, very where they performed very, very well, where they were very, very resourceful, where they were very, very calm. Or if they've never had that experience, create that. Create a psychological state of calmness, of resourcefulness, of stillness. And then when that is, that experience is at its peak, at its zenith, do something notable, like clench their preferred hand into a fist and hold it. And we build in a strong association between that particular triggering anchor, that is the clenching of the fist in this example, to that psychological state that is associated with either the memory or that new state. And so then with as little as 3 to 5 practices of that for about 5 to 10 minutes, then what that athlete can do is when he or she recognises, or when his or her coach or training partner recognise that they're getting anxious, they can create that psychological state by firing off that trigger.
Excellent. Fantastic. I mean, one of the a book that I harp on a lot about, a massive proponent of it, is a book called Psycho-Cybernetics by Maxwell Maltz. And for me, one of the critical points I derived from that was that the human psyche struggles to differentiate a real memory from one that you essentially plant in your own mind.
Yeah, that you by, program. Yeah.
Exactly, that you program yourself by, you know, creating those memories and reiterating them again and again until essentially your mind interprets it as a real memory anyway. So I find that really interesting that you point that out by that exercise of repetition until ultimately it does become a reality.
Regrettably, we also saw that reinforced through horrendously unethical psychology and psychiatry experiments back in the 1950s, 60s and 70s, where they would subject participants in these experiments to ordeals torturous-like ordeals,
right,
and then convince them of a particular untruth. You know, and so you torture someone and have them tell you that the sky is pink. And if you kept using aversive therapy, kept on torturing someone, eventually they would actually believe that, horrendously unethical.
Wow. Yeah, Coach Chris, I'd like to change directions here, if I may.
Please. You are the master of changing directions.
You know, I'm trying my best here. But I really want to know what motivated you to take on what I imagine must be a massively underappreciated and I guess at times thankless role as an official for MMA events.
Thank you. If you're the moment you mentioned thankless, you could only be talking about MMA officiating.
You guys do a great job. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I consider officiating in MMA to be an enormous privilege, especially, and this is on the public record, I am blessed to be able to work with the premier MMA sports league, the Ultimate Fighting Championship in Asia, as an MMA official, which I take very, very seriously, and I'm very thankful to the organisation. With regards to your question, way back in 2006, when I was coaching at Team Takedown, I was working as a psychologist. The Victorian Professional Boxing and Combat Sports Board approached me, and they actually said that this new sport of cage fighting, some promoter, I think it's Johnny Skeeter, wants to put a no rules fight on one of his kickboxing cards at the West End Hotel. Do you know anything about that? Because someone gave us your name, and can you help us regulate this? And I actually thought, by that stage, I'd been swapping bootleg VHS UFC cassettes with people in... no one heard that. Forget that last 10 seconds. Had also...
You and me both, Chris.
And had also helped... Coach Larry Papadopoulos and Coach John Donoghue organised amateur C-class Shooto MMA events in Melbourne. I thought this is a great opportunity. Instead of being like so many people saying, oh, wouldn't it be great if the UFC came to Australia? Wouldn't it be great if we had MMA? Actually being somebody who tried to get it running. So I put my hand up, got involved in helping to draft the initial rules, because the unified rules of the Association of Boxing Commissions didn't exist at that stage. And I refereed the very first match, which resulted in a very good karate exponent, David Slatter, roundhouse kicking his opponent clean unconscious.
Wow.
And there's this photo sequence of me absolutely startled running in to body lock him before he did any more damage. And wow. So that's how I got started. And then more, and as the UFC grew in notoriety, and then there's a brief period of time where they were showing packaged segments on free-to-air television, and then the sport exploded. There was a UFC magazine that was available at service stations and right. then so forth. People were wearing Tap Out. Let's not talk too much about that. Then more and more bouts became regulated in Victoria. I then was blessed to actually meet my very dear friends, Stephen Percival and Greg Clagens, who invited me to officiate with them in Tasmania, and invited me to their referee and officiating association, MMA Federation of Australia. And then in 2011, I was asked to work as a fight inspector with MMAFA with the UFC in its Sydney match, Sydney event, which was a great privilege.
Wow, it's amazing.
Now, you mentioned thankless. Can I actually say that I please implore all competitors, coaches, trainers and fans in not just MMA, in all sports, to please recognise and respect the role that officials play, because sport wouldn't exist if it wasn't for officials.
Yeah, I think it's really easy to get caught up in the emotion surrounding any outcome of a sporting event and lose sight of the fact that, as you just said, without the officiate, officials, the event simply can't take place. It's as simple as that.
Definitely a thankless job anyway. My handful of experiences refereeing...
I refereed you!
You did. That was my first exposure to you.
In a submission grappling event.
I was very fortunate to have you raise my hand. Thank you. Appreciate it.
I love it. I absolutely love it. So, Coach Chris, tell us about your book that you recently had published. Now, let me get this right. It's called Wrestling with Resilience.
Hey, how's that for a catchy title,
lads? I love it. A Handbook for Developing Resilience and Mental Toughness.
Thank you very much for graciously asking. That wasn't a setup at all. It's written with my lifelong friend and colleague and my PhD supervisor, Associate Professor Simon Moss. It is currently it's in preparation. It will be released thereafter, although Amazon's listing it already, which scares me. What I will say is I've been continually asked by participants of workshops, by wrestlers, by jiu-jitsu and MMA players, and by other people as I go around incidentally, do I have some resources about how we can overcome stress? Do I have some podcasts or web links or physical books or ebooks that I can recommend to deal with anxiety? Could I recommend a particular book for getting the best out of myself as an athlete? And what I've done dutifully is put together about 20 different sources and recommended it to those people of us.
So it sounds like a compendium.
Indeed. And so then the bright idea came to me about 5 years ago. Well, no one source, you mentioned a compendium, Brenton, no one source is I believe, meeting those requests that is mired in empirically based research. So I thought, hey, I'll write it. Pitched it to a publisher who loved the title, the Wrestling with Resilience.
What's in a name?
It's all about the pitch, lads. I've been slowly writing it as I've been accruing experience over the years. And Simon Moss, who's head of psychology at Charles Darwin Uni, has been proffering the research for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm very, very proud that my very first book will be published a little bit later on this year.
That is absolutely incredible. Congratulations.
Thank you, lads.
So I imagine the sequel will be called Guard Pulling for the Tough.
I'm going to leave right now. I'm mortally affronted and will be walking out of here right now.
Okay, please tell me it's going to be on Audible. I mean, with read by your own voice.
No, thank you for asking. Well, if anything, I was thrilled. I spoke to my publisher, Black Knight Books, the other day, and they're releasing it as both a physical book and e-book, I'm quite keen to actually release a spoken version and so forth.
Please do explore that path.
Well, I'll explore it with you, because you're my technology guru over here.
Sure.
So, Chris, I've actually got a wrestling resource at home, a book called Wrestling Tough.
I think that's outstanding.
I think that I've read the book probably 15 times.
That's a very good
tome. And then I've read
tome.
It in partial sort of attempts probably another 20 times. So it sounds to me like I'm due to get a new book. So once that book has been released, will we be able to get you to share for our listeners' benefit where they'll be able to get a hold of that?
Of course. Thank you for the kind request. Wrestling Tough is an outstanding book. I also endorse, from a wrestling perspective, A Season on the Mat, which follows Coach Dan Gable's Iowa Hawkeyes through a season in the 1990s. Zen in the Martial Arts by Joe Hyams was a seminal book for me. I've worn out about 5 different copies. I've now got it as an e-book, of course. There's a lot of psychology we've discussed. I use a contemporary body of psychology called positive psychology,
right,
in a lot of my work, which is very much about enhancing techniques and tools to enhance people's mental health. One of the key proponents is Professor Martin Seligman. He has a book called Flourish, which I highly endorse as well. Further to those that I've just listed, the way I'm consuming knowledge now, my partner and I deliberately have eschewed physical books.
Right.
So in our home, there are no physical books. Now, she's studying at the moment, yet all of my books, particularly my psychology textbooks, are in my clinic. So everything I'm consuming now, in answer to your question, is electronic. I'm following quite a lot of podcasts, including yours. Congratulations, Chips. On the interview with Coach Daniel Kelly.
Thank you.
Who I think as a result of your interview won his last match.
Clearly.
And won't take all the credit, but...
No, but he was 15.4% more effective on the night.
Hey, that's rounding up.
I can't identify any specific tomes, yet what I will say is read and view widely, listeners. 2017, there's open learning, there's universities opening up their courses to people. Now is the time to learn about anything and everything.
Excellent.
Hey, Coach Chris, tell us about what's on the horizon for you in 2017. What do you got planned? What's in store?
Thank you. I'm gleefully super busy at the moment with a couple of things that I'm doing concurrently. The first is I have been engaged by my valued clients, both individuals and organisations, so I absolutely want to continue to bring innovative and helpful psychological strategies and principles to help them in their work and their lives. The second is I'm doing my PhD. The third is my PhD is examining techniques to improve the resilience of individuals and organisations.
Yep.
My book with Simon Moss is coming out soon. Furthermore, you have engendered and evoked a little bit of interest. I'd like to see if I can get back on the jiu-jitsu mats. Although I don't know about this stuff where you fall on your back like a turtle. You know, I don't know what that is.
It's just the path of submitting someone quicker.
That didn't exist in 2006. You know,
it's a cunning plan.
The dark side.
Further, I'm delighted to announce that I'm exploring veganism as well. So I'm endeavouring to become a vegan athlete.
Your partner Mia is a vegan, yeah?
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct. And
so what's the motive behind that? I mean, everyone's got a different reason for yourself.
You. I love animals, and when I've explored the way animals are treated during the food production industry, it shocked me. And so as a slightly yet in very good shape older bloke, I am exploring veganism for animal rights and so forth. And I'm endeavouring to maintain my muscle mass and still keep training as a vegan athlete. And of course, current Mr. Olympia is vegan. Arnold Schwarzenegger has recently turned to veganism as well. There absolute MMA athlete Claire Fury Forum is a vegan athlete who my partner admires, and I'm going to hit you Tal to please get an autograph for my partner. there's a bunch of things, and then my partner and I are keen to do some travel as well, particularly because up until I retired from wrestling, I did a lot of travel, yet it was mostly going from airport to wrestling mat to, you know,
it was stressful. It wasn't for leisure.
Yeah, whereas now I can travel for leisure.
Yeah.
Great. Now, Chris, in wrapping the interview up, on behalf of Coach Mac Brenton and myself, I wanted to really thank you for taking the time out to see us. You're an OG of the jiu-jitsu and grappling scene in Melbourne. We were all really excited about this opportunity, and very genuinely so. Often when we are as excited about having a guest on the podcast, we create this sense that is that the time that we spend together is going to be absolutely fantastic. And in this case, you've exceeded those expectations. So on behalf of the three of us, I know for me personally, I've got a lot out of it. Talking to Brenton before we kicked this off, we're both really excited about seeing you. And please come back.
Thank you. Coach Steve, Coach Brenton, Coach Mac, thank you for your kind words and your welcome. It's been an absolute pleasure. I look forward to maintain our warm and sincere relationship and keep going with this wonderful podcast.
Thank you very much.
And when can we expect to see the book?
Amazon, the reason I'm pausing is I'm just trying to be precise here. Amazon have listed it for August 2017. They seem to know more about it than I do as the author. So I imagine it'll be coming out soon. Of course, all of you here will be invited. Not you listeners, that'd be too many. But all of you here will be invited to the launch. And I'll give you a personally autographed copy. Kaboom!
Love it. Absolutely love it.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, lads.